Part 4. The Directorate of Administration. Chapter 16. Laundering Money. The Directorate of Administration, while only a support element, is no different from the other directorates in thinking that its job is the most essential. It is this directorate that keeps the other pieces of the agency in place. Without it, no one in the CIA would get paid, no one would be hired, and no one would have any computers, communications, heat, or electricity. Most important, without the directorate's Office of Security, opposing spy agencies could infiltrate moles into the CIA or bug the office of the CIA director himself. With 9,000 employees, it is the CIA's largest directorate. This is the directorate that buys the pencils and paperclips, orders the phones, and processes new employee applications. These are normally prosaic duties. But because it services the CIA, the Directorate of Administration can be as exciting as any James Bond thriller. It has its covert side, the cover stories and cutouts, which often rival those of the operations side of the agency. Within the Directorate, the Office of Security is responsible for the physical security of the CIA. It conducts background investigations of new CIA employees and CIA contractors, administers polygraph tests to employees and agents, debugs offices at Langley and overseas stations, patrols the buildings and grounds, protects the director and other key CIA officials, and investigates security problems. With the help of the FBI, it also investigates espionage. Some of the CIA's most serious abuses have been perpetrated by this office. Besides administering the finances of the agency, the Office of Financial Management launders money using dummy corporations and multiple bank accounts worldwide in order to further the work of the clandestine side of the agency. The Office of Medical Services administers physicals to employees and supplies security-cleared psychiatrists to help them with psychiatric problems. It operates a psychological profiling unit that issues psychological analyses of world leaders such as Saddam Hussein. It also helps out in analyzing specimens, from feces to hair, of world leaders to determine if they have any health problems that might affect their longevity or judgment. Finally, at various times it has gotten involved in such esoteric matters as determining if ESP would help uncover drop sites of the KGB. The Office of Training and Education trains CIA employees. It operates Camp Peary, a supposedly still-secret CIA compound near Williamsburg, Virginia, that teaches the tools of the spy trade, how to recruit and handle agents, how to avoid surveillance. The office's courses include instruction in area studies and 25 languages. It also manages publication of Studies in Intelligence, a classified CIA quarterly journal. The Office of Communications not only orders phones, but provides top-secret coded communications by satellite throughout the world. The Office of Information Technology runs the vast array of computers needed to keep each of the directorates functioning. Overseas, it arranges for quick-burn devices to destroy computers in case an embassy is taken over. The history staff within the directorate consists of three historians who obtain recollections of officers who have retired and write a continuing classified history of the CIA. A Freedom of Information Office processes requests for documents under the provisions of the Freedom of Information Act. The Office of Personnel keeps the agency staffed by recruiting on college campuses, running ads in newspapers, overseeing hiring, and administering psychological and other tests to applicants. Recently, it began a new program to assist retired CIA officers adjust professionally, economically, and psychologically to life in the private sector. The Office of Logistics not only moves employees and offices and provides couriers for delivering top-secret documents, but also buys guns and ammunition and runs so-called proprietaries, companies such as Air America that are owned by the CIA. Through Fairways Corporation, a longtime CIA proprietary, the office operates the CIA's planes, including regular flights to Camp Peary, the training center. The office manages the agency's procurement system, the printing plant, photographic facility, mail system, motor pool, courier system, and food services. The entire monolith would grind to a halt without the office's real estate and construction branch, which runs the CIA's physical plant and maintains its grounds. In this area, as in others, the most important goal is secrecy. Chapter 17. Langley. From a distance, the only unusual feature about the CIA's compound is Virginia Power Company's 113,000-volt transmission line, which is needed to power the agency's massive computers. It enters the agency's property at the left of the main gate on Dolly Madison Boulevard at Georgetown Pike in McLean. Originally, highway signs marked the location of the CIA from George Washington Memorial Parkway in Virginia, but Robert F. Kennedy, who was Attorney General at the time and lived nearby at the family's Hickory Hill estate, asked the CIA to take them down. "Bobby Kennedy said, 'This is the silliest thing I've seen. Please take the signs down,'" William Colby, Director of Central Intelligence from 1973 to 1976, said. "We pretended that the building wasn't there, even though every pilot used it as a checkpoint going down to National Airport." When James R. Schlesinger became Director of Central Intelligence in 1973, he asked Colby why the CIA had no signs. Colby told him the story. "I think we should have signs," Schlesinger said. After Schlesinger checked with the White House, the signs went back up. Today, highway markers along Dolly Madison Boulevard going northwest say, "CIA next right." But sometimes they temporarily disappear again when souvenir hunters snatch them. Closer up, one can see double chain-link fences topped with barbed wire surrounding the compound. The fence is marked with the standard signs: U.S. Government Property, No Trespassing. Each segment of fence is fitted with a tiny black plastic box, part of a system that sounds an alarm in the Office of Security's duty office when the fence vibrates. "All non-badged visitors must keep right," a sign says along the access drive. Other signs warn that the speed limit is 25 miles per hour. Speed is checked by radar. Explosives are prohibited. Visitors turn into a separate lane, where another sign tells them to drive up to a post equipped with an intercom and closed-circuit television camera. Just as in a drive-in hamburger stand, a visitor tells the guard at the other end what he wants. The guard asks for his Social Security number. If the visitor has an appointment, his Social Security number will already be registered on a computer list. The guard then instructs the visitor to pull up to the main guard gate, a concrete and glass structure 25 feet beyond the intercom. There, the visitor must show picture identification. If everything matches, the guard gives him a visitor's badge, a parking permit with a map of the parking lots, and a form to sign. The form gives the CIA the right to search the visitor. If anyone tries to enter the compound without permission, the guard can flip a switch and raise a steel barrier that revolves out of the ground. Just in case, the guards, who wear broad-brimmed hats that make them look like park rangers, have machine guns and guard dogs. Just after Webster appointed William M. Baker to be the CIA's Director of Public Affairs, Baker returned to Washington's National Airport from a trip. Baker's wife, Robin, a flight attendant, had just gotten off a plane herself at National. It was 10 p.m. and they had to drive back to the CIA's compound to pick up Baker's car. Robin Baker viewed her husband's new job with trepidation. Baker had spent his career at the FBI, where he had been Webster's Director of Public and Congressional Affairs. When Webster asked her husband to take the CIA job, Robin Baker was apprehensive. Like most people, she wanted nothing to do with the CIA. This was to be her first encounter with the agency. Robin Baker drove to the CIA's main gate. Mercury vapor lights blinded her as she drove up to the concrete guard gate. From the passenger side, Baker showed his CIA building pass. "Lady," the guard snarled at Baker's wife, "you dim your lights when you come up here." Robin Baker had not seen a small sign that said "parking lights only." "I don't like this place," Robin Baker muttered as they drove into the parking lot. During the 2 years that Baker assisted Webster, Robin Baker visited her husband's place of employment again only once, the day he left. The CIA compound is indeed a spooky place. Even its location, Langley, Virginia, is not what it seems. In fact, it does not exist. Langley is the name of an estate that was owned by a member of the family of Robert E. Lee, who led Confederate forces in the Civil War. Originally, Langley was the name of the Lee family's estate in Shropshire, England. The estate in Virginia bordered Georgetown Pike, originally an animal trail formed by the hooves of buffalo on their way to feeding grounds in Maryland and the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. Later, the Susquehannock Indians used the trail when they brought furs to English traders who anchored their ships in the Potomac River. The Lee estate included part of what is now the CIA compound. Langley later became a village with its own post office inside a country store, an inn with a tavern or ordinary where stagecoaches stopped to rest their horses, a blacksmith, and a weigh station where farmers could weigh their hay before taking it to market in Washington. By 1910, the village had been merged into nearby McLean, named for the then publisher of the Washington Post and the principal stockholder in an electric rail line that linked the area with Washington. Because of the rail line, there was no need for a separate village so close to McLean. The Langley post office was closed. Today, Langley does not exist, yet because the CIA is located in the area once called Langley, it is commonly described as being in Langley. The agency as a whole is often referred to as Langley as well. When the agency was started in 1947, the CIA had its offices in some 25 buildings all over Washington, many of them temporary wooden structures around the reflecting pool in front of the Lincoln Memorial. The buildings were so rickety that it was not uncommon for safes used to hold classified documents to come crashing down from the upper floors. Headquarters was a brick building with white Ionic columns next to a Navy medical building at 2430 E Street Northwest in Washington. Alan Dulles, who became Director of Central Intelligence in 1953, wanted a permanent headquarters in the suburbs. For public consumption, he would say he wanted a campus-like atmosphere to symbolize the agency's scholarly pursuits. But the primary reason was security. The government's emergency plans called for locating sensitive facilities away from Washington, which would presumably bear the brunt of any atomic attack. A secluded area would be easier to police as well. At the same time, the agency had to be close enough to the White House to make it easy for the CIA director to see the president. Since 1940, what was then known as the Federal Public Roads Administration had been assembling 742.9 acres of land off Georgetown Pike for its research facilities. This agency, now known as the Federal Highway Administration, was not using most of it. The land was 7 miles northwest of the White House, an ideal compromise between the need to get away from Washington and the need to be near the president. Dulles saw the property and fell in love with it, Walter N. Elder, an assistant to Dulles at the time, said. The CIA obtained 225.5 acres of the land for its headquarters. The Federal Highway Administration's Turner-Fairbank Highway Research Center, which tests highway barriers and cars for crashworthiness, still occupies a tract that the Roads Agency retained outside the CIA's acres. On a map, the CIA's compound looks like a giant weather balloon, with its top jutting toward the northeast just below a crook in the Potomac River. The mouth of the balloon forms the entrance to the compound, which is where Dolly Madison Boulevard and Georgetown Pike come together, forming the apex of a triangle. In the records of Fairfax County, the CIA is part of Parcel 22-3-01-00-40, with land assessed at $235,932,200. This parcel extends northeast well beyond the CIA compound to the Potomac River and includes the Highway Research Center, which is northwest of the CIA. Because it is all held in the name of the U.S. government, the assessors do not distinguish between the portion held by the CIA and the portion used by the Roads Agency. In 1955, President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed a bill authorizing $46 million for the construction of the CIA headquarters complex. On September 20, 1961, the first employees began to move into the new building, a concrete and glass structure that consists of 1.4 million square feet. There was one problem. The Public Roads Administration, in assembling the original land, had been unable to obtain a last 32.5 acres that jutted like an iceberg into the tract where the CIA planned its compound. Moreover, it was right at the mouth of the property, just to the left of the access drive, that the CIA wanted as its main entrance off Dolly Madison Boulevard. The land had been purchased in 1933 by Margaret Scattergood, a graduate of Bryn Mawr College who had worked for the original American Federation of Labor doing economics research. With Florence C. Thorne, a friend and co-worker, she purchased the home, along with a tenant farmer's house and a maid's house that sat on the property. When the federal government tried to take the property, she got a private law passed allowing her to stay there undisturbed until she died. In the meantime, title passed to the government, and she received $54,189 for the property immediately. In the records of the Fairfax County Assessor, this parcel is designated as 22-3-01-00-40A and is assessed at $6,492,000. When they came to work each day, CIA employees drove past Scattergood's home with its wide front porch and columns. Few knew anything about her and what she stood for. The daughter of a wealthy dye-maker in Philadelphia, Scattergood was a Quaker and a pacifist. The CIA, in her view, meant war and killing, everything she was against. Scattergood helped civil rights organizations and was corresponding clerk of the Langley Hill Friends meeting in McLean. But she spent most of her time doling out money from a trust fund left by her father to anti-war and other liberal causes. Meanwhile, she wrote letters to members of Congress urging cuts in the military and intelligence budgets. She also gave sanctuary to refugees from Nicaragua and Guatemala, illegal aliens fleeing the turmoil in the two countries where the CIA was heavily involved. Occasionally, they ended up at the CIA's gate as they tried to find Scattergood's driveway, which was off an access drive to the CIA's rear entrances. She had an income of $100,000 to $125,000 a year, perhaps. But she had no mortgage, no taxes. She lived a simple life, she and Miss Thorne. So she gave away between a third and half of her money each year, Nancy H. Blanchett, a grandniece and executor of her will, said. When the CIA began widening its front access drive in 1983, Harry E. Fitzwater, the CIA's deputy director for administration under William Casey, learned that Scattergood was worried that the agency would intrude on her property. For some time, Fitzwater had been concerned about Scattergood's welfare. Since her home extended into the CIA's grounds, it was probably more secure than the White House. But Scattergood was advancing in age. Since Thorne's death in 1973, she had lived alone. Fitzwater had had the CIA's guards patrol her property to make sure she was okay. Fitzwater invited Scattergood and a grandniece, Sylvia Blanchett, to have lunch in the director's dining room and to tour the CIA. After they sipped sherry, Casey dropped in, and they had lunch with him. When the subject turned to the American Revolution, the subject of Casey's 1976 book, Where and How the War Was Fought, An Armchair Tour of the American Revolution, Scattergood said, "My relatives were in jail at the time." "What do you mean?" one of the CIA people asked. "They were Quakers and were doing civil disobedience. They don't believe in war and don't believe in killing other people and would rather go to jail and lose everything rather than participate in war," Scattergood replied. Scattergood died on November 7, 1986, at the age of 92 after a stroke. She had lived on the property 25 years after the CIA occupied its headquarters building, a last show of disobedience. After Scattergood's death, the CIA extended its chain-link fence to include her property. The house is used for training sessions and will eventually be used for CIA conferences. On part of the property just to the left of the front gate, the CIA built a daycare center for 104 of its employees' offspring. Each child is enrolled by code number. From Soviet satellites, it looks like the CIA is training midgets, or so the joke goes. To the right of the CIA's front access ramp stands a massive 19-room brick home. Built in 1988, the home at 1124 Saville Lane sat unsold for 2 years. A new broker, Kathy Gill, got a bright idea. Why not sell it to the CIA as the home of the director? She approached both the CIA and members of Congress, who took up the cause with William Webster. But the agency wanted no part of it, and a Saudi diplomat eventually bought it in 1991. Besides the main entrance, the CIA has two rear entrances off Georgetown Pike and a side entrance off the George Washington Memorial Parkway that runs along the Potomac River. In 1977, three Marine officers saw the security measures as a challenge. They got drunk in Washington's Georgetown section and decided to prove their manhood by scaling the CIA's fence. Well past midnight, they parked their car along the George Washington Memorial Parkway and made a run for the fence near the side entrance. Alarms went off in the duty office just behind the CIA's main lobby, pinpointing the exact location of the intrusion. By the time armed security guards reached the area, one of the Marines was already inside the compound. The guards drew their guns and stopped the Marine. With the help of Fairfax County police, they caught the other two as they ran back toward their car. The CIA reported the incident to Quantico Marine Base, where the officers were assigned. Each got 2 weeks in the brig. Organizations opposed to the CIA occasionally station members near the CIA's entrances so they can write down or photograph employees' license plates. In the 1970s, these efforts led to the publication of some names of CIA employees. Soviets masquerading as picnickers did the same thing. Since then, state motor vehicle departments have made it tougher to obtain the names of owners of motor vehicles. The CIA's rear entrances are off an access drive that leads from Georgetown Pike to the Federal Highway Administration's Turner Fairbank Highway Research Center. Trucks with deliveries for the CIA use the first entrance. Across the street from the second rear entrance is Claude Moore Colonial Farm at Turkey Run, a 100-acre replica of a Virginia colonial homestead that is open to the public. Occasionally, 250-pound razorback hogs, denizens of the farm that resemble boar, squeeze out of their pens and amble past the CIA's guard posts onto CIA property. Other lost souls may get less gentle treatment. At the height of the Persian Gulf War, motorists who wound up at the CIA's rear entrances while looking for the Turner Fairbank Research Center or the Claude Moore Farm found themselves confronted by CIA guards who ordered them out of their cars before they would give them directions. Guard dogs, normally inside the guard posts, stood at the ready outside the gates. In 1985, construction began on an addition to the CIA at the rear of the compound behind the old building. The first employees began moving into the addition in June 1988. The new building has 1.1 million square feet. Unlike the old building, which has tiny slits for windows, the new building makes use of large expanses of green-tinted glass, giving it the appearance of a multicolored silicon chip. With the new building, the CIA's land and structures, along with the Turner Fairbank Research Center, are assessed at just over $500 million. Just over half the CIA's 22,000 employees work at Langley. 15% work overseas, and the rest work in some 22 CIA offices scattered throughout Washington or in the CIA's domestic stations. Visitors to the CIA may be directed either to a lot on top of a parking garage in front of the new building or to the VIP parking lot in front and slightly to the left of the old or original building. Inside the compound, there are tall oak trees that occasionally sprout closed-circuit television cameras. Near the front entrance of the old building are weeping cherry, magnolia, and tulip trees. At various times, azaleas and rhododendron bloom near the old building, and daffodils and tiger lilies adorn the beds. A futuristic concrete bus shelter rises in front and slightly to the right of the old building. Here, blue and white shuttle buses pause on their way to other CIA offices around Washington, and Metrobuses let off employees who take the McLean-Crystal City line. In the late 1970s, a Soviet diplomat got off the bus in an apparent attempt to test CIA security. A CIA guard who checks building passes as passengers alight put the man back on the bus. Just behind the bus stop is the CIA's 7,000-square-foot auditorium. Because of its globular appearance, the auditorium is known as the Bubble. A tunnel connects it to the old building. Next to the auditorium stands a statue of Nathan Hale. During the American Revolution, Hale volunteered to go behind British lines and spy. The British captured him on September 21, 1776, and hanged him the next day. His last words were said to be, "I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country." 15 doors at the main entrance lead to a lobby of different shades of gray and white Georgia marble. Along the left wall is a statue of William J. Wild Bill Donovan, Director of the Office of Strategic Services, the forerunner of the CIA. On the wall is a biblical inscription from John chapter 8, verse 32. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Along the right wall are 53 gold stars flanked by an American flag on the left and a flag with the seal of the CIA on the right. Each star represents a CIA officer who lost his or her life in the service of the agency. Beneath the memorial stars is a glass case that displays a book listing the years when the officers died. In some cases, the names of the officers are listed. Richard Welch, for example, who was killed by terrorists in Athens in December 1975, after the English-language Athens News published his name and home address. Most of the names are not listed because the officers were operating undercover, and their affiliation never came out. When Admiral Stansfield Turner was director of Central Intelligence, the memorial book disappeared for 2 weeks. Turner's assistants were frantic. Could someone have stolen one of the CIA's most revered possessions, a symbol of the dedication and sacrifice of every CIA officer? The Office of Security was called in to investigate, but it could find no clues. Finally, just as suddenly as it had disappeared, the book reappeared in the display case. It turned out that a CIA employee who was supposed to add a new name to the book had gotten tired of waiting for the Office of Security to give him the key to the case, so he pried it open without telling anyone. Visitors present their signed visitor forms to one of the receptionists at the far end of the lobby. The receptionist calls the employee listed on the form, and the employee comes down to escort the visitor. If the visitor is going to the director's suite on the 7th floor, he is usually taken to the director's elevator to the left of the lobby. From the elevator, the director can descend to the garage, where 30 of the agency's top officials are allowed to park. In July 1991, Dr. Stanley Moskowitz, the agency's director of congressional affairs and formerly associate deputy director for intelligence, left his car in the garage. Later in the day, the Office of Security called him. Would he mind stepping into the garage and opening his trunk? It seems a dog trained to sense explosives had fingered his trunk for harboring a bomb. Because of Dr. Moskowitz's status, a second dog was called in. The dog confirmed the diagnosis. No problem, Moskowitz said. He opened the trunk to reveal the item that had offended the dog's senses. Workout clothes concealed in a gym bag. The director's elevator operates only with a key that is given to those who report to the director. Other visitors, and employees routinely going to work, use one of six turnstiles to enter the rest of the building. Armed guards watch as the escort first inserts his or her identification card in the turnstile and punches in a code. Then the visitor inserts his or her visitor card. The card must be inserted again when leaving the building. Each time a card is inserted, a second bar closes behind the person using the machine. If there is anything wrong, he or she is trapped. Every hour or two, there is the sound of a buzzer and nervous laughter as a quirky turnstile malfunctions and traps an employee or visitor trying to enter or leave the building. The guards usually explain that the turnstiles are malfunctioning. They lower the gate to let the embarrassed employee pass. The new building has its own entrance, with 16 turnstiles at the end of an arched skylight of green-tinted glass. The addition is airy, with escalators and an atrium filled with potted palms. Because the new building is on higher land, the fourth floor of the old building connects to the lobby of the new building. Many of the offices in the new building, and the director's offices in the old building, are so-called vaulted areas, where less sensitive classified documents can be left on desks overnight. When the last person leaves, he or she calls security, flips a switch, and locks the door. For all the high-tech gadgets, employees who want to place calls between the old and the new buildings on non-secure lines must dial a 7-digit number, just as if they were calling outside the CIA. However, practically everyone uses the secure green touch-tone phones to make calls within the agency, even when making lunch dates. The secure phones require 5 digits when calling within the CIA. The corridors inside both old and new buildings are lined with artwork. Formal portraits of each of the directors of Central Intelligence, signed photographs of American presidents since the agency was established, and a rotating exhibit of the work of local artists under the auspices of the CIA Fine Arts Commission. Recently, the exhibit featured the Vincent Melzack collection of Washington Color School painters. Mainly geometrics, polka dots and stripes and other repeated patterns, They were by Tom Downing, Howard Maring, Gene Davis, Alma Thomas, Norman Bloom. Occasionally, employees leave their belongings on the floor as they gaze at the exhibits or bulletin boards listing cars for sale or houses for rent. When one man forgot to take his briefcase after resting it on the floor, the Office of Security confiscated it and took it to a concrete-lined bomb disposal enclosure on the grounds. Fearing it might be a bomb, the guards blew it up, depriving the man of his lunch and some papers he had been working on. The architects who designed the old building wanted it to be state-of-the-art, so they included a conveyor belt in the walls for carrying packages from one office to another. When officials of the Office of Security saw it, they threw up their hands. The system would make it too easy to distribute bombs throughout the building. The system was never used, and the passageways inside the walls are now used to store backup batteries for the CIA's vast banks of computers. Where the new and old buildings meet is a rectangular courtyard dotted with black plastic picnic tables. In one corner of the courtyard is a part of an installation by Washington artist Jim Sanborn, who was chosen after a competition among 200 entrants. It took Sanborn 2 years to build the work, which includes 3 other pieces within the courtyard and at the entrance to the new building. The cost was $250,000. The main piece is a sculpture that stands more than 6 feet high and looks like a scroll. Constructed over a pool of water, it is made of petrified wood, granite, red slate, green quartz, and copper. The petrified wood symbolizes the trees that once stood on the CIA's site and the fact that they are used to make paper and record language. Letters carved in a curved copper plate at the right of the installation represent a table that can be used to decipher the encoded text cut into the plate at the top left. The text can be deciphered only by using the table and a keyword, which is cryptos. Another plate at the bottom left contains more text, which can only be deciphered by computer. Sanborn composed the message in the encoded text with the help of a fiction writer. Totaling 2,000 words, the combined messages describe the information-gathering role of the CIA. Sanborn entrusted only Webster, as the then-director of Central Intelligence, with a deciphered copy of the text at the opening for the artwork in November 1990. Sanborn found the experience of working on CIA grounds unnerving. One day he showed up to work on the installation only to find that his art material, 25 tons of granite, had disappeared. Was the agency checking the stone for bugs? Was it part of some nefarious plot to stifle his creativity? The CIA never explained. It simply issued him a check for $5,000 so he could buy new stone to replace it. Agency officials speculate that maintenance workers, thinking the rock was left over from construction of the new building, simply hauled it away. Off the courtyard in the new building is a plum-colored employee cafeteria, separated into 2 dining areas, one for undercover officers and the other for everyone else. The old building has another gray-accented cafeteria where employees can take visitors. The tuna sandwich is just $2.25. Also off the courtyard in the old building is the CIA's National Historical Collection, 2 rooms enclosed in glass and crammed with memorabilia of a bygone era. Here is the first United States flag to fly over CIA headquarters, the razor that William Donovan used during World War II, Russian railway schedules purloined by the CIA in the late 1940s, a camera the size of a matchbox, a device that detects movement and is disguised as dog feces, and a lantern that was to be used to guide planes landing in Cuba during the Bay of Pigs invasion. One of the cases holds a .22-caliber pistol with silencer that Donovan showed to President Roosevelt in the White House. To demonstrate how quiet it was, Donovan shot a round into a sandbag that he'd brought along for the purpose, then handed the hot muzzle to the startled president. A day after the United States began the war to liberate Kuwait in January 1991, Linda McCarthy, the CIA exhibits officer, donned a pair of white gloves and carried a Civil War Colt 44 to the ladies' room to clean it. Around a bend in a corridor came an excited CIA security guard. "We had a report of a weapon," he said. "The worst I could do with this is throw it at you," she said dryly. "I was about to call in backup," he said. Not far from the museum, on the first floor of the old building, is the CIA's main library. With smaller specialized libraries in each directorate, The CIA has 146,000 volumes, including 25,000 books on intelligence. This is the largest collection of intelligence books in the United States. A lower level of the library has 1,700 newspapers and periodicals on file. Below the first floor in the old building are a gym and a barbershop. When he was director, this is where Webster got his hair cut by one of two barbers. The new building also has a gym. When he first came to the CIA, Baker, Webster's director of public affairs, went to work out in the gym in the old building around lunchtime. He had just finished his routine and was taking a shower when he heard women's voices. They sounded angry. It turned out the locker room had separate hours for men and women. While Baker was taking a shower, the hours had changed. The women were irate because he was cutting into their time. In his FBI career, Baker had arrested armed robbers and had participated in shootouts. J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director, had commended him for arresting more fugitives in one day than any other special agent. But the locker room situation was a new one. As he ran to his locker to get a towel to wrap around himself, Baker identified himself. "Sorry, sorry," he said as he scurried into a closet to get dressed. At the rear of the compound, behind the new building, is the CIA's electrical substation, printing plant, a helipad, a car wash for the agency's motor pool, and a loading dock for receiving mail and supplies. Looming over the electrical substation is a water tower that helps maintain water pressure in the area. Because of new construction in McLean, the pressure changed one afternoon, sending a geyser of water 20 feet into the air. As the water rained down, CIA workers went scurrying to find the shutoff valve, only to learn to their horror that it was buried underground. Using shovels, they frantically dug holes in the area until they found the valve and shut it off. Despite backup generators, the CIA's power supply has also gone on the fritz. At least twice, electrical components have malfunctioned, shutting off even emergency power to the agency and its computers. Nonetheless, when this happened under Stansfield Turner's regime, the only complaint the engineers got was that Turner had not been able to eat breakfast. The agency has its own zip code, 20505, at the Washington, D.C. post office. Because mail to the CIA is screened at the post office by X-ray equipment, the McLean post office is too small to handle the load. A second X-ray machine at the loading dock checks packages when they arrive. These are under the control of the Office of Security, in many ways the most controversial office in the CIA. Chapter 18. Keystone Cops. When people picture the old CIA, they are most likely thinking of the Office of Security. It was the CIA's Office of Security, starting in 1967, that illegally infiltrated and spied on dissident groups in Washington, D.C., in order to protect agency buildings. It was the Office of Security that illegally wiretapped the telephones of three newsmen in 1959 and in 1962 in order to determine their sources. It was the Office of Security that illegally incarcerated Soviet defector Yuri Ionosenko, who defected from the Soviet Union after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, for 3.5 years, beginning in 1964. It was the Office of Security that arranged for the Mafia to try to assassinate Fidel Castro, and that ordered poison pills for him to take. And while investigating CIA employees, the Office of Security illegally conducted 12 break-ins and installed 32 wiretaps and 32 bugs. Nor has the office's heavy-handed approach changed appreciably. As recently as 1985, it contributed to the decision of KGB Colonel Vitaly Yurchenko to re-defect to the Soviet Union by treating him as a prisoner. When Yurchenko's handlers complained to the Office of Security about the treatment, they were told that was the way things were. There was nothing to be done about it. As Director of Central Intelligence, William Webster had more problems with the Office of Security than any other office. He found it to be still operating in the Dark Ages and most resistant to change. Sometimes Webster's aides felt that perhaps the Office of Security considered Webster to be a security risk. Their attitude is, this is the way we do things and we aren't going to change, a former Office of Security official said. Even letters sent out by the Office of Security to notify employees that they had failed polygraph tests were clumsy. The letters said, "You have been deemed deceptive on the issue of providing information to a foreign government." At the suggestion of an assistant, Webster had the office change the letter to say, "You evinced physiological reactions," and the matter was resolved in favor of the national security. In plain English, that meant you're fired. Of all the office's functions, none is more important than preventing espionage. While the CIA's counterintelligence center works overseas to thwart opposing intelligence services that try to recruit CIA officers, the Office of Security is charged with protecting CIA facilities and people from penetration. It is, to be sure, an impossible task. No one can expect that the KGB and other hostile intelligence services will never have any successes in the silent espionage battle. Nor are statistics meaningful. Since 1975, the Justice Department has prosecuted 56 spy cases, of which 6 involved CIA employees or employees of CIA contractors. A 7th case, that of Edward Lee Howard, a former CIA officer, has never been prosecuted because Howard fled to Moscow, where he now lives. A warrant has been issued for his arrest. Of the 56 prosecutions, all but one has brought a conviction. The fact that an espionage case has occurred does not automatically mean that the Office of Security has failed. One can always wish that the office had done better, that it might have gotten lucky and caught a spy who decided to sell out his country. But just as the FBI cannot be expected to stop all bank robberies simply because that is the Bureau's job, the Office of Security cannot be expected to stop all espionage against the CIA. What can be expected is that the Office of Security will follow its own procedures and will have enough understanding of the law to preserve suspects' rights so they can be convicted if guilty. In all too many cases, the Office of Security has failed in these areas. Indeed, of all the CIA's offices, the Office of Security is the one most likely to be heavy-handed where sensitivity is called for, most likely to overlook proper legal procedure, and most apt to yearn for the days before the Church Committee hearings when the CIA was far less accountable to Congress. Nowhere is this attitude better illustrated than in a talk that Jerry G. Brown has given often to new CIA employees. Brown joined the Office of Security in 1956 and most recently headed its clearance division. Heaping ridicule on the efforts of the Church Committee and the presidentially appointed Rockefeller Commission that investigated the abuses, Brown said the CIA's Operation Chaos, the effort to investigate domestic dissidents, was seen by our unsophisticated detractors as a purposeful attempt by the agency and the Nixon administration to subvert the domestic political process by spying on American citizens. This was not the case at all, Brown claimed. In fact, he said, Operation Chaos represented an effort to address serious national security questions. In saying this, he overlooked the fact that by spying on American citizens, the CIA had violated its own charter. Those who would destroy us and our efforts were not the Soviets and our other worldwide enemies, but our own elected legislative representatives, Brown declared. While Brown acknowledged that some reforms were needed, the investigators did not want to hear the truth, he said. The tragedy of the Congressional and Rockefeller Commission inquiries into Operation Chaos was that none of the staff investigators bothered to find out how the operation began, Brown said. If they had, they would have found that it began with what Brown called a serious problem, the leak in 1967 to Rampart's magazine of the fact that the CIA was secretly funding the National Student Association. According to Brown, this funding was essential so that the National Student Association could fight Soviet efforts to control international youth organizations. The tip to Rampart's, he said, was one of the most flagrant leaks of classified information ever known to the agency. And who leaked the information? According to Brown, it was the KGB, who obtained the information directly from the CIA and gave it, through individuals peripherally connected with the magazine, to Rampart's. The exposure of the agency's involvement with the National Student Association by Rampart's was totally inspired by the KGB, Brown said. Brown claimed the CIA learned this information from a Soviet defector. The claim fit in neatly with his theme that the Church Committee investigations into CIA abuses were misdirected. The leak contributed to greater scrutiny of the agency, and that led to investigations that threatened CIA employees who had participated in the abuses. The only problem was he was wrong. In order to fund the student organization, the CIA had had to tell hundreds of National Student Association officers over the years about the secret program. As the source of the story, the Ramparts article named Michael Wood, a National Student Association employee who had been told about the funding by one of these officers. The author of the piece, Saul Stern, and Cord Meyer, the CIA officer in charge of the CIA funding operation, both corroborated the fact that Wood was the source of the story. Having learned about the secret funding as the result of a conversation with an excessively loquacious NSA officer who did know the facts about the CIA's funding, this young man, Michael Wood, decided it was his duty to expose the whole relationship, Meyer wrote in his book Facing Reality, From World Federalism to the CIA. The CIA's naivete in thinking that it could inform successive generations of the association's officers about the funding without its leaking to the press had led to the scandal in the first place. In suggesting that the leak to Ramparts was a sinister KGB plot rather than the inevitable result of spreading the word among hundreds of young students, Brown had overlooked the obvious. But far more troubling is the failure by a senior official of the Office of Security entrusted with training new employees to recognize that by subverting the law, the CIA subverts the very freedoms it is trying to preserve, while failing to achieve its objective. The same unfocused thinking led to one of the major screw-ups in the history of U.S. espionage investigations, another one where the Office of Security was involved. It was the case of Carl F. Koiker, a Czech intelligence service officer who managed to get a job at the CIA in 1973 as a translator. With his stunning wife Hannah, Koiker attended sex orgies and wife-swapping parties in Washington and New York. At the parties, Hannah Koiker, also a Czech intelligence service officer, would take on 4 to 5 men at the same time. But it was all for the cause. Many of the partygoers were fellow CIA employees who swapped classified information as well as sex with the popular couple. Through his translation work, Koiker learned enough to compromise Alexander D. Ogorodnik, a high-ranking Soviet diplomat working as an agent for the CIA. When the KGB confronted him, Ogorodnik committed suicide by taking a poison pill concealed inside a fountain pen given to him by the CIA. After a Czech working for the FBI turned Koiker in, the Bureau, which has responsibility for investigating espionage by Americans, followed him for 2 years without developing enough evidence to prosecute him. In an attempt to get him to confess, the CIA's Office of Security and the FBI devised a plan to approach him in the fall of 1984. As an officer of the Office of Security would later tell new CIA employees, the FBI and CIA had absolutely no thought of prosecution. Rather, the idea was to find out how much damage Koiker, who had become a U.S. citizen, had done. This is a classic blunder. The agencies investigating espionage become so fixated on finding out what happened that they forget about an equally important goal, prosecuting suspects as a deterrent against future espionage. Often there is another motive for avoiding this. Prosecution leads to publicity, which can be embarrassing to the agencies involved. A bank that has been defrauded would just as soon not see the case plastered all over the papers, but it has no choice. The CIA and other intelligence agencies can try to hide their mistakes by claiming that prosecutions would air secrets that would compromise the work of the agencies. For 20 years, the CIA had a secret agreement with the Justice Department that if criminal conduct occurred within the agency, and it involved classified information that would have to be disclosed outside the CIA, the agency would resolve it internally. That changed under Attorney General Griffin Bell, who decided that no individual in government should be immune from criminal prosecution. In 1978, the CIA strenuously objected to prosecuting William P. Campiles, a former CIA watch officer assigned to analyze incoming traffic at the CIA's operations center. Campiles had sold portions of a top-secret technical manual on how to use the KH-11 surveillance satellite to a Soviet agent in Athens for $3,000. What the manual showed was that the satellite transmitted its data up to another satellite instead of down to Earth, as would be expected. Because of this ruse, the Soviets thought it was a dead satellite. Bell took the issue of prosecuting Camp Hiles to President Carter, who authorized it. In 1980, the CIA argued against prosecuting David H. Barnett, a former CIA officer who had been over CIA operations in Jakarta. Barnett got $92,600 for letting the Soviets know that the CIA, through Operation Habrink, had found out how to control the guidance systems for their SA-2 surface-to-air missiles. As a result, Habrink was compromised. Barnett also identified for the Soviets 30 CIA officers and many of their agents. The fact that the Soviets already knew that Barnett had given them the information did not deter CIA officials from insisting that Barnett should be let go. Somehow the CIA felt any public discussion of the case would damage the agency and its operations. Very often, according to John L. Martin, chief of the Justice Department's Internal Security Section, who supervised the case, the CIA simply wants to avoid the embarrassment that comes with publicity about its penetrations. Other CIA officials sincerely believe that any information about their operations can only help the other side, a throwback to the days when no highway signs marked the location of CIA's headquarters, even though airplanes used the building as a landmark when flying into National Airport. The intelligence community had come to believe that every time you prosecuted a spy, you would lose the secret, and that it was better public policy, the best of two evils, to let the spy go and keep the secret, Bell said. But I had the idea that you could prosecute these cases without losing the secret. In fact, with professional handling, investigators can prosecute suspects and find out what has been lost. The FBI, in investigating Ronald Pelton, a former National Security Agency employee, did just that. After conning Pelton into revealing what he gave away, the FBI turned the case over to Martin of the Justice Department for prosecution. Often the Justice Department agrees to bring to the attention of the sentencing judge the fact that the suspect has cooperated in return for a guilty plea and full disclosure of the spy's activities. That happened in Pelton's case, but he still got life in prison. In the case of Czech Intelligence Service officer Karl Koiker, none of this was done. The Office of Security and the FBI, in effect, promised Koiker that he would not be prosecuted if he talked, that he could become a double agent for the CIA, pretending to work for Czech intelligence while reporting to the CIA, and that he could return to Czechoslovakia if he wished. In fact, neither the FBI nor the CIA had any intention of making Koiker a double agent, thus making the offer improper. Koiker served time in prison waiting for his trial. But in the end, because of the false promise of immunity from prosecution, the Justice Department had to settle for trading Koiker rather than incarcerating him. As part of the deal, Koiker pleaded guilty to espionage. When the CIA's Office of Security later examined how Koiker had been hired by the CIA in the first place, it discovered that his polygraph exam had been poorly conducted. When asked if he was under the control of a hostile intelligence service, Koiker showed some signs of deception. However, Koiker explained away his nervousness by claiming he had briefly tried to serve as a double agent for the FBI. Instead of asking more questions and administering a second test, the polygraph examiner moved on to the next question. The same lack of care occurred when the Office of Security polygraphed Larry Wu Tai Chin, who was hired as a CIA translator even though he was then working for the People's Republic of China. In a subsequent confession to the FBI, Chin said he had managed to avoid showing deception because the CIA asked all the questions in English instead of in Chinese, his native tongue. It was easier to lie in a foreign language, he said. At least in part, the Office of Security was also responsible for the fact that nearly all of the Cuban agents recruited by the CIA over the years have been double agents. Of the 38 Cuban agents working for the CIA at the time they were first exposed in 1987, nearly all had taken polygraph tests, and most had passed. The test results of many of the other agents were deemed inconclusive. Polygraph tests are not infallible. The hoary aphorism that the machines are only as good as their operators is true. In this case, the operators had a major deficiency. They did not speak Spanish. In contrast, the FBI was able to avoid accepting many Cuban double agents because it generally administered polygraph tests to them in Spanish. Only one CIA operations officer has ever been prosecuted for espionage. Laxness by the Office of Security contributed to the damage he did. Operations Officer David H. Barnett began telling the Soviets about CIA operations in Indonesia in 1976, after he had left the agency to start his own business. Faced with mounting debts, he reapplied to the CIA and was hired. At that point, the Office of Security should have polygraphed him, just as all new hires are polygraphed. If he had been polygraphed, his earlier spy activity would presumably have come out. Instead, he was allowed to teach tradecraft to CIA officers who were about to go overseas. In this position, he had extremely valuable information to offer the KGB, which he offered to sell at a meeting with them in Vienna in April 1980. When American government agents spotted him in Vienna, the FBI entered the case. However, when the agents first asked about Barnett at the Office of Security in February 1980, they were told he no longer worked for the agency. Later, it turned out that either the Office of Security or the Directorate of Operations had failed to record the fact that he was again working for the CIA. From February until March 1980, the FBI watched Barnett 24 hours a day. During that time, the CIA removed him from his sensitive job without letting him know why. Barnett pleaded guilty in 1981 and was sentenced to 18 years in prison. Two other espionage cases, that of Christopher J. Boyce and his friend Andrew Dalton Lee, the protagonists in The Falcon and the Snowman, and William P. Campiles, who sold the manual to the KH-11 spy satellite to the Soviets in Greece, also stemmed in part from laxity by the Office of Security. Boyce held a relatively low-level, low-paid position with TRW Incorporated, which was a CIA contractor on the spy satellite program. He gave classified code material used to transmit photos from the Rhyolite surveillance satellite to Lee, a drug addict. Lee sold it to the Soviets in Mexico City and shared the proceeds with Boyce. In congressional testimony, Boyce would later describe security at TRW as being so loose that he and his co-workers regularly partied and boozed it up during working hours within the Black Vault, the super-secret room housing information on the CIA satellite project. Bacardi rum was usually stored behind the crypto machines, he said, while a code destruction machine similar to a blender was used for making banana daiquiris and Mai Tais. It was the CIA's Office of Security that was responsible for making sure security procedures were followed by CIA contractors. The Office of Security was also responsible for keeping tight control over classified documents. To be sure, the Office of Security has helped to apprehend spies. But unfathomable screw-ups sometimes mar even those success stories. The best example is the case of Sharon M. Scranage, who was a 30-year-old operations support assistant for the CIA in Ghana. She gave classified information to her Ghanaian boyfriend, Michael Susudis, a first cousin of Jerry Rawlings, Prime Minister of Ghana. The case began in Ghana in 1983 when Scranage invited an Office of Security officer to dinner at her home. On the way to the bathroom, he noticed a photo of a man taped to the vanity in her bedroom. The man turned out to be Susudis. The photo showed Susudis sitting in Scranage's bed, the covers drawn up to his naked chest. The security officer returned to dinner and warned Scranage of the dangers of romances with local nationals, particularly one with a connection to the government. At the time, Ghana was pursuing a staunchly capitalist economic policy, but a left-leaning foreign policy, cozying up to Cuba's Fidel Castro and Nicaragua's Daniel Ortega. The security officer and a colleague told the CIA station chief about the romance, and the station chief warned Scranage to break off with Susudis. Scranage promised she would. Susudis subsequently stayed in the United States for almost a year. But when Susudis returned to Ghana, their affair resumed. It was not until Scranage returned to the U.S. for a new posting in the summer of 1985 that the Office of Security gave her a polygraph test. When the test began to show signs of deception, Scranage at first denied any wrongdoing. Eventually, she admitted she had given her boyfriend extensive secret information. If she did not go along, he made it clear he would break up with her. In fact, she handed Susudis virtually everything there was to know about the CIA's activities in Ghana. She even gave him top-secret cables that she copied in shorthand, then recopied for her lover in longhand. Her spying led to the compromise of 8 CIA agents in Ghana who were arrested and imprisoned. In addition, the pro-Marxist head of Ghanaian intelligence is believed to have passed on information obtained through Scranage to the KGB and Cuban intelligence. Scranage agreed to cooperate with the FBI and Jerry Brown of the Office of Security to catch Sisoudis, who was an agent of the Ghanaian government. The FBI arrested him at a Holiday Inn in Springfield, Virginia. After pleading guilty in 1985, Scranage was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Later, the sentence was reduced to 2. Sisoudis was returned to Ghana in exchange for the release from prison of the CIA's 8 agents. The CIA has resettled in the U.S. nearly 24 Ghanaians, including families who were compromised as a result of the fiasco. The agency has since tightened its regulations on reporting relationships with foreign nationals. While the Office of Security had helped apprehend Scranage, its delay in polygraphing her after it became clear she had been dating a relative of the Prime Minister was inexcusable. Unlike a failure to forecast a political event, this was an avoidable mistake. Indeed, of the 6 Justice Department espionage prosecutions of CIA employees or employees of contractors to date, only one, that of Edwin G. Moore II, who threw a package of CIA documents over the fence at a Soviet apartment house in Washington, did not involve any mistakes by the Office of Security. More recently, the Office of Security botched one of the biggest spy cases in history by insisting on treating KGB spy Vitaly Yurchenko as a prisoner. This contributed to his decision to redefect 3 months after he left the Soviet Union in 1985. As the most important KGB officer ever to defect to the U.S., Yurchenko had in his head information about dozens of cases of interest to the Office of Security and the FBI. While he gave away 2 major cases, that of Edward Lee Howard, the former CIA officer who defected to Moscow, and Ronald Pelton, the former NSA employee who spied for the Soviets, Yurchenko had clues to many more. The CIA and FBI had meant to debrief him for years. If they had, he would almost certainly have led them to a number of other spies. When Webster became director of Central Intelligence in 1987, the lawyers that he brought with him from the FBI found that of all the CIA offices that deal routinely with legal issues, the Office of General Counsel, the Counterintelligence Center, and the Office of Security, the Office of Security was most likely to flout legal procedures. One example was the Great Postage Stamp case, which involved 9 workers in the Office of Security's mailroom who noticed that $1 U.S. postage stamps had been misprinted. They sold 85 of the stamps, now valued at $28,000 each, to a New Jersey stamp dealer for an undisclosed sum. When the Office of Security learned about it, they interrogated the suspects without warning them of their right to have counsel present. Eventually, 4 of the employees were fired because they had made statements during the investigation that were technically true but misleading, or because they had not returned the stamps they had taken, or both. If the cases had been criminally prosecuted, they would most likely have been thrown out because the employees had not been warned of their rights. To improve the operations of the Office of Security, Webster appointed new directors who came from outside the office, one from the Directorate of Intelligence, another from administration. While they were not burdened by the Office of Security's mindset, they did not have the experience in law enforcement needed to give them the confidence to make wholesale changes. For his part, Webster did not want to become heavily involved in the operations of the office, realizing that trying to micromanage its activities would only lead to more problems. In any case, much of what the office does would be done the same way, regardless of who is in charge. Debugging is one example. Chapter 19. Getting the Bugs Out. Within the Office of Security, nearly 100 technicians engage in a never-ending battle to find wiretaps and other eavesdropping devices in the CIA's offices at Langley and around the globe. Besides helping to investigate espionage and other crimes, polygraphing people, taking care of the buildings and grounds and locks, and guarding defectors, the Office of Security looks for eavesdropping devices. Given the threat, this is one of the most important jobs in the CIA. Besides finding bugs, the Technical Security Division within the Office of Security installs white sound systems to mask voices, as well as state-of-the-art alarm systems, safes, locks, and other security systems. But the main job of the office is finding bugs by conducting periodic sweeps of the agency's buildings in Washington and stations overseas. While usually based in Washington, the technicians spend most of their time traveling to CIA stations in their quest for elusive bugs. A standard office can present dozens of possibilities for bugging, and CIA technicians have to check them all. Any speaker in a radio or television set can be turned into a bugging device that radiates signals to a remote listening post. An electrical outlet can be replaced with one that contains a bugging device that transmits signals through the air or over the power line. A microphone in a thermostat can transmit signals to the furnace, where a transmitter can beam the signals outside. Rewiring of a telephone can turn it into an open microphone, transmitting sound in the room down the telephone line even when the receiver is on the hook. Typewriters are not immune. The power supply used by an IBM Selectric typewriter can be used to pick up what the typewriter is typing. Each time the typing element moves, the motor inside the machine runs. The amount of time the motor operates depends on how far the typing element moves. In turn, the amount of movement is based on which letter is being typed. By measuring the amount of current drawn, a snooper can determine how far the typing element has traveled, and thus which letter it typed. A computer screen also radiates signals that denote which letter is being typed. A microphone in a room can also be used to pick up sounds from the keyboard. Each key, when struck, makes a different sound. That sound can be used to determine which key was depressed. Likewise, a daisy wheel computer printer emits sounds that can be translated into the text that it is printing out. If a computer has a modem, so long as the computer is turned on, a snooper can obtain the entire contents of the computer's hard drive over the telephone line. In checking for electronic eavesdropping devices, CIA technicians try to pick up any signals that might be transmitting sound from a room. This is not as easy as it sounds. In debugging the American embassy in Moscow, State Department technicians did not find the bugs implanted in the embassy's IBM Selectric typewriters, in part because of the clever way the Soviets masked the signals. The bugs stored data and transmitted it only intermittently. The Soviets controlled when the bugs dumped information and could turn them off when a sweep might be in progress. Moreover, the coded signals used the same frequency as a Moscow television station. When the bugs transmitted, viewers heard momentary static. Since the signals were on the same wavelength as the television station, sweeps of the embassy detected nothing. In debugging overseas stations, one of the biggest problems CIA technicians face is not bugs, but insistent requests from ambassadors to sweep their offices. "It's a status symbol," a former technician said. "If the chief of station gets his done, the ambassador wants his done, too." The State Department sweeps its own offices, including those of ambassadors. But when CIA technicians visit stations overseas, many ambassadors insist their offices need a check as well. When that happens, CIA officers assigned to the stations often apply pressure to go along with the request. But according to a former technician, "We've been told we'll be canned if we do it. The State Department doesn't want to send men and equipment there if we have just been there." Depending on the size of the station, two or three technicians take 1 to 2 weeks to perform their sweeps. Depending on their sensitivity and the degree of the threat, the stations are checked every 6 months to once a year. The director's office has devices that constantly detect any stray emanations that might come from bugs. In addition, the office is swept, along with the office of the deputy director of Central Intelligence, every 6 months. To keep in top form, the technicians look for bugs that are placed by the CIA's buggers, the Office of Technical Service within the Directorate of Science and Technology. The bugs are placed in homes and apartments previously used as safe houses. There is a rivalry between the two offices, and the positive buggers often do not want to share their latest techniques and devices with the debuggers. The technicians find bugs at overseas stations only occasionally. In one case, while checking the airwaves at a station overseas, they heard the voice of the chief of the British intelligence station there. It turned out the British had given the local security service some outdated bugging devices. The first thing the local security service did was to install one of the devices in the office of the British officer who had supplied them. The Office of Security performs sweeps of the office of the Director of Central Intelligence, his car, and his home every 3 to 6 months. They also sweep the rest of headquarters. CIA technicians have never found a bug in Langley. Sometimes they think they have found one in the director's office when they find a strange new wire. But in every case it leads to a buzzer installed to signal a request for coffee and tea, or to some other newly installed gadget. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack, a former technician said. It could be anywhere in a building. You can bust your chops looking, never find anything, and never be sure if it was behind the next wall. You are never sure. To find technicians who can debug offices, as well as the dizzying array of other specialists needed by the CIA, the CIA has an agency-wide office of personnel that looks for practically every area of expertise listed in college and technical school catalogs. But finding people who will become spies takes a special approach, which is the primary purpose of the CIA's career training program.